funding for Think is made possible by SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How have information networks changed the human relationship to knowledge? For most of our history, the amount any of us could know was limited to what we could hold in our brains. As literacy spread and printed books proliferated, we could also access knowledge we had not memorized. We developed a special reverence for facts and ideas documented on paper and did the best we could to organize them appropriately by subject. But 21st century technology changes all that, exponentially broadening the sources of information available to us and providing new ways to organize, analyze, and access it that my guest believes have the power to change our very definition of knowledge. David Weinberger is senior researcher at Harvard's Berkman Center for the Internet and Society. His new book is called Too Big to Know: Rethinking Knowledge Now That the Facts Aren't the Facts, Experts Are Everywhere, and the Smartest Person in the Room is the Room. David, welcome to Think.
Hi, Chris.
You remind us here that our skulls don't scale. What does that mean?
Our skulls don't get any bigger. They start off really small in a world that is really, really big. Mm-hmm. And as we learn more and more, know more and more in our culture, our skull's capacity doesn't get any bigger. And so we've had to come up with strategies for dealing with this limitation, not only of skulls, which is, you know, pretty much a permanent thing, but also of the medium of knowledge in the West, which has been paper, because paper doesn't scale all that big. Mm-hmm. Bigger than a skull.
Yeah, and so if our search for knowledge is linked to our search for things like patterns and relationships, even within books, there's only so much we can do with that information.
Yes, so every book succeeds, if it succeeds, by pretty drastically limiting what it's going to talk about. Mm-hmm. Whether you're covering some topic, the topic cannot be any bigger than the book, because the book has a finite limit, and you have to try to get everything in there that the reader will need, because books are also, for all of their wonderfulness, they're also a very disconnected medium. They're disconnected from other books, so that you know it will be hard for your readers to pop out of the book and go read the book that you're referring to in what you're writing, or to follow the footnote. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's there, but it's really hard to do. So we've structured knowledge in many ways around the limitations of books and paper as our medium.
Yeah, so each book is a discrete unit, and it is not convenient or instantaneous, for example, to go, as you mentioned, to a book that's mentioned in the footnotes.
Yeah, in fact, it's often much less than inconvenient. It will mean often getting on a bus and going to a major city and finding your way to the big public library and hoping that the volume is there. And libraries themselves. I mean, I work in a library. I really like libraries, but libraries deal constantly. They're premised on the notion of limit and the scarcity of space, of shelf space. There's only so many books you can get in. And something like the Encyclopedia Britannica, formerly known as the world's greatest encyclopedia, it only has 65,000 articles. It only has so many volumes, 32 volumes to play with. And so every year, a topic, one of the famous ones is Oliver Goldsmith, an important poet of the 19th century. It gets cut down. We get less and less because they're trying to make room for what's new. So we have all these techniques for dealing with the scarcity of our medium, but it's a very serious constraint that we often not only do we miss, but we actually have turned into a virtue for knowledge.
Hmm. Yeah, and so as great as books might be, they were also very much controlled by a limited number of gatekeepers who decided not only what was worthy of publication, but which publications were worthy of inclusion in collections.
Yes, and if you have few enough curators, then there's, even though they're very well-intentioned, and historically they have been, it results in a type of implicit censorship. Mm-hmm. The gatekeepers have their own biases because they're human beings, and they're certainly doing the best job they can, and they're very knowledgeable in many cases, in most cases. Nevertheless, it's been basically a bunch of white men who have decided what overall in our culture what's gotten published over the past 2,500 years.
So it worked as long as it worked, and it continues to, printed material is not going anywhere for the time being. But talk about how the way we look at knowledge has changed in this era that we can now search things and cross-reference things and instantaneously link from one source of information to another.
Well, so I think that we're seeing it move from a set of content of true things that we are justified in believing, which is the classic definition from Plato in the West, to something that's more than that, that's more inclusive than that, that where we find knowledge these days is primarily on the internet. That's where most of us go in order to engage in knowledge seeking and development activities. That's just where knowledge is, and I think that its knowledge is taking on properties of the internet just as it took on properties of books. So just as books are, the ink sinks into the paper and it's settled once the book is published, you can't really change it. And so we've had this idea as well that knowledge is that which is settled. But you go out on the net, and not only is there just so much more, so scalability is not an issue anymore. We have every good and bad idea, every true and false piece of information, in fact, it's all available to us in a way that it wasn't before. Everybody gets to be an editor. Everybody gets to be a curator, as many people have pointed out. But the result is that you go out on the internet, and we don't have the nice, safe sense that we used to have coming into a library or into a textbook, that this is something we can manage. We've got this. We know how to do it. We can, you know, get it into one room or into one book. It just doesn't seem possible anymore. And furthermore, we see that we're not going to agree about anything.
Mm-hmm.
We had a very comforting and useful idea until recently in the West, an Enlightenment idea that actually goes back even further, which is that knowledge is what brings us together, that we can all ultimately, all reasonable people will ultimately agree on the facts and on the knowledge that around those facts. But we don't have that sense on the internet so much anymore. We now see just how widespread the disagreement is. We see how crazy and stupid some people are and how smart and other people are. But we don't have the sense that the internet is ever going to agree about anything. And so I think we are coming up with strategies for rapidly advancing our knowledge, not only in the face of this perpetual disagreement, but actually taking some advantage of this perpetual disagreement.
You know, the disagreement thing is interesting because, you know, there are facts upon which reasonable people can disagree. And then there are also, as you mentioned, the things that are simply preposterous. But we've entered a world in which knowing that at least certain people believe the preposterous stuff is part of knowing everything there is to know about a subject.
Yes. And not only are we coming to realize that there are people who believe preposterous things, but there is no amount of convincing that's going to convince them, that we are now in a situation where they will always be with us. And because the primary piece of the constituent of the internet is the link, we always have access to them, whether we want to have access to this or not. They're there.
Mm-hmm.
It's very different because there are always cranks and crazy people in the world, as well as serious cultural differences that we cannot overcome. But there's always been the cranks. We just didn't hear from them because the media was so scarce. There's so little made it into the news or into the nightly broadcast of the news, and it was so tightly controlled. So we didn't hear from them as loudly. Not only do we hear from them, but we can engage with them directly if we want to, and they will engage with us even if we don't want them to.
And the idea is not that there is too much information in the modern world. It is simply that we need really good, appropriate, I should say, filters to put that information in perspective.
Yes. So there's always been too much to know. The world's always been way too big. As Clay Shirky, a writer and internet thinker, has put it recently, there's no such thing as information overload, only filter failure, by which he means, I believe, that throughout our history we've had periods when we have felt overwhelmed, but all that's really happened is that our filters needed some tuning. So I think that's true and wise and comforting, but there's also a discontinuity. There's something new happening, and not only in the staggering increase in the amount of information, although that's important, it's also that the filters work differently on the internet. So when you filter in the real world, if you're a publisher and you're getting all these manuscripts in, you reject some, most of them you reject, and nobody ever sees them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you filter them out. Or if you're a library, you take some books in, but you reject most of the published works, and people don't see them. On the internet, when you filter, if you are an editor or a curator, which is to say that you have a blog or you're sending around an email saying, here's the three greatest articles I read this week or whatever, all that you're doing is reducing the number of clicks that it takes for somebody to get to those articles. Everything else that you didn't choose It's all completely available. It will show up in a Google search or in somebody else's email or social networking site and the rest. Nothing is removed. And so we have layer upon layer upon layer of filter all over the place. And each of these adds some value. It's very messy, but each adds some value because they're a way of looking at the world and bringing that bit of the world closer. That's a very different model than the old knowledge model that said, let's set up a peer review process with experts. They'll do a wonderful job, and frequently they did an excellent job. But these peer reviewers will look at the flood and pick out the few things of interest and make them available. That model has benefits for sure, but it sure does not scale.
David Weinberger is my guest. He's senior researcher at Harvard's Berkman Center for the Internet and Society and author of the new book, Too Big to Know, Rethinking Knowledge, Now That the Facts Aren't the Facts, Experts Are Everywhere, and the Smartest Person in the Room is the Room. You can join our conversation by calling in now to 1-800-933-5372 or emailing think@kera.org. I want to take a quick break from this very interesting discussion with David Weinberger to talk to you, update you on the status of our winter membership campaign. I am joined by Vice President of KERA, Jeff Ramirez. Hey, Jeff.
Hey, Chris. The show sounds great today, as usual. I'm actually delighted to be here. People might be wondering where Jeff Whittington is, because Jeff
got the two Jeffs
on the air here with you. Jeff is actually out sick today, so he's resting up, getting better, and so we hope to see him back here tomorrow. It is the winter membership campaign, and like you've heard us say quite often, this is your opportunity to call in or go online and join the station for the very first time. If you've been a fan of Think for what, going on 4.5 years now, and if you haven't already called in and joined the station, become a member for the very first time, now is your opportunity, because we're trying to wind down the membership campaign. You've been hearing us talk about how right now we're endeavoring to complete the drive in half the time compared to last year, around the same time. And Chris, last year the drive is 24 days.
That was a long time.
That's over 3 weeks, almost a month. Well, you know, getting the membership drive done in half the time this round means that you're really going to get back 12 more days of what it is that you really love about KERA. So please do call in right now with your contribution. The toll-free number is 1-888-694-6931 or click and join online at kera.org.
We are hoping this hour of Think to have a total of 28 contributions to the station. That should be easy because you only have to do one of those if you have not yet done so. We have 24 to go actually in this hour. So thanks to the four of you who have already gone online to kera.org or called in to 1-888-694-6931. We have some folks to thank.
Yeah, Chris, we are always so delighted to thank listeners who've already made a contribution by calling in or using the internet. Smita and Shalish Patel in Irving, thank you so much. Lynn Doyle in Euless. Miss A.C. Stone over in Fort Worth. Also Monica and Jeff Hedgeland in Fort Worth. Thank you so much for your contribution. And right now, during this first hour of Think, we are counting down. Our goal is
28 for this hour.
We've already got 4 in the door, so that means we're looking for 24 more. So please do call right now, 1-888-694-6931, or contribute online at kera.org.
Perhaps you are a fan of KERA, a fan of Think, and you are in a position financially to make a contribution at our friends level. That's $1,500 or more per year. We can break that out for you into a sustaining membership, which would be $125 a month. Maybe you can do $5 a month or $10 or $20. Whatever amount you want to contribute to the station, we have fascinating ways to say thanks, including copies of David Weinberger's book, Too Big to Know. That's available at or above the $120 contribution level. You can find out how to get your copy by going online now to kera.org, or you can call in to 1-888-694-6931. Your contribution keeps public radio strong, ensures that a show produced here in North Texas like Think can continue. So thanks very much for your participation. Again, go online to kera.org or call 1-888-694-6931. Thanks.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU Continuing and Professional Education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. Learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with David Weinberger. He's senior research at Harvard's Berkman Center for the Internet and Society and author of the new book, Too Big to Know, Rethinking Knowledge, Now That the Facts Aren't the Facts, Experts Are Everywhere, and the Smartest Person in the Room is the Room. Join our conversation by emailing think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372. David, I want to talk about this. You mentioned the fact that applying a filter to the internet or acting as a filter oneself doesn't eliminate other information that's out there for people to access. And part of the reason for that is that we no longer have a credible reason for getting rid of old information because we have pretty much unlimited capacity to store it.
Yes, and that changes things. Mm-hmm. It lowers, vastly lowers the hurdle to what gets published and things get saved, at least for a while, by default. And one of the obvious issues, persistent issues with the internet is that there isn't a good way of archiving it. There's internet.org, which is a really sort of wonderful attempt by an individual who's built an organization, Brewster Hale, to archive it, but there isn't a systematic way of doing it. Nevertheless, not only is the content public, but the interactions are public, and the links are public and persistent. And so one of the things I think is really interesting and very promising on the internet is that we're seeing within some of the cultures on the net, in particular, in this case, the software developers, we're seeing a culture of learning in public emerging. So if you're a software developer and you have a question, a problem with some program that you're trying to write, you can get answers incredibly quickly, usually just by Googling what the problem is, what the error message is, and you'll find a site where people are talking about it and improving one another's answers and posting the very code that you need. And not only does this make software developers very efficient at this point, there's an increasing assumption among them that the right thing to do is to learn in public. So rather than education being the sort of the internal instruction of a person's character and brain, that's selfish. Whenever possible, you should learn in public in a way that improves the public sphere so that other people can benefit from what you have learned or what you've taught. And that type of persistence, the persistence of the development of knowledge is I think, amazing and really, really helpful and hopeful.
And it seems to be that no one could have predicted how well this would work. I'm thinking about something like Wikipedia, which has turned out to be remarkably accurate, even according to people who are not affiliated in any way with the site, as compared with standard professionally written encyclopedias in hard copy. And yet there are lots of people who still think one should not trust anything that is open to the public and available in such a way.
Yes, and it's certainly an understandable fear or concern because it goes so against our intuitions. Our intuitions born of 2,500 years of practice. We have pretty much nailed down in our culture how you do knowledge the old way, and we're very good at it. You know, we make great encyclopedias, and so when something comes along that works in exactly the opposite way, that it succeeds because it violates just about all of the old rules about how you make good knowledge, of course we are suspicious and doubtful, but as they say, the proof is in the pudding, and Wikipedia is a remarkably reliable source of information that's actually, I think, serving a really interesting social role.
And this kind of crowdsourcing can actually allow us to know more about things than if we limited ourselves to experts. Because, for example, if there is a breaking news event and you have 50 people witnessing it from different perspectives, they can give you more than any one reporter, any one expert could possibly say about the experience.
Yes, this is the networking of knowledge. And I think it's important to keep in mind that experts play a hugely important role in this new networking of knowledge. It's not that the experts go away, and those of us who have the genuine privilege to hang out with experts, they're awesome. They're irreplaceably awesome. Nevertheless, their expertise not only gets more widely disseminated on the internet, which is a wonderful thing, but it inevitably gets caught up in webs of discussion, people who take their insights and argue with them and maybe improve them or get some clarification or explain them to people who are not in that field or apply them to new areas, rightly and wrongly, and discussion grows up around that. And these webs that include experts and also include non-experts and others, these webs seem to me at their best have much more value than any individual expert can have.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak to Yassine in Richardson. Hi, Yassine.
Hi. I'm so happy to be on the show, and it's an amazing topic.
Welcome.
I had two questions. Well, a question and a comment. You were earlier talking about expertise, how they used to filter things, and this idea of filters. And if you could just speak on like sites like Reddit, where like you have this upvote and downvote mechanism, and it actually is impactful on what gets shown on the first page, as opposed to like something like YouTube, where you can say, "Oh, this has a ton of dislikes," but it's still going to pop up in the search. And then the other thing would be just about bias and on search results that present themselves as authoritative. I'm thinking about like if you pretty much look up anything about the religion of Islam, you're going to find a website maybe that says like Answering Islam, but it's not at all like an unbiased source. But maybe it's just that it's more, because of all these different filters, it's more easily able, you're easily able to see that it is biased, whereas in the past you wouldn't have been able to as much.
Thanks for your call. What do you think about all that, David?
So this is a great question. I love Reddit. But the two instances that you give, Reddit and search engine bias, are actually two sides of the same coin. So at Reddit, anybody can suggest an interesting link, and then the community, which is anybody who goes there, votes it up or down. And the front page of Reddit presumably reflects the interests of that demographic, if I may, which seems to skew pretty heavily male and quite young. And so you get a whole bunch of things that are of interest to that group and maybe not to, you know, 61-year-old folks. Nevertheless, it is one of the sites that does a good job of continuously surfacing really, in addition to the sort of fun stuff, which is fun, but really interesting points of view and people who represent other ways of thinking about things, other cultures, and the like. And furthermore, at Reddit, these topics, these links that get voted up, spawn conversational threads. Frequently hundreds, sometimes thousands of them, those get voted up and down too, which have, you can see there a new type of community interview and a new way of a community sort of sussing out what's right and what's wrong. So people will sometimes offer themselves to be questioned at Reddit. This is called IMA. And it's spelled I-A-M-A.
Mm-hmm.
So I am NPR radio host. And you will get, and you are now offering to answer questions, frankly, over the next few hours. And people will ask questions and you'll answer. And if you don't answer truthfully or fully, or people sniff that maybe there's something, there's a little weaseling going on, they will be all over it. Far better than most professional journalists are able to do. It's really pretty amazing. Bias in search results is the other side of this. I mean, so at Reddit, you get this filter that goes through this particular set of people. On search engines, you get the results that are judged by the algorithms to be most significant based upon the large community of web users, and that can very easily reflect some very serious prejudices and ignorance. Fortunately, search engines are not the only way we get information, although they're pretty important.
We've also reached a point in our history where our technological and scientific history, where because of algorithms that we set up and things that we analyze via computer, we can see patterns and recognize things to be true, even if we have no theory whatsoever for why that is the case. Can you talk a little bit about that and what that means in terms of sort of back end trying to figure out what this data means?
Yeah, this is one of the most interesting things happening, I think. So there's the rise of big data. So in various fields, various disciplines, organizations are releasing huge clouds of data, often in raw form, without bothering to process them, because it's more important to get this information out than to sift through it endlessly and delay the release of information. That's actually very much the case at data.gov, which is where federal agencies release their big data. Mm-hmm. It's released raw, so we'll have it faster. So we have these huge clouds of data that would never fit in any single brain, but their computers can sort of troll through them and make connections and discover things. And where the data is sufficiently complex, it's not possible for us to go back and understand exactly how things relate. It's emergent phenomena, that is, phenomena that arise from a system so complicated that we can't follow each of the pieces.
Mm-hmm.
That type of inquiry, whether it's for predicting the weather or the economy or understanding even how a single cell works, is giving rise to a type of knowledge without human understanding.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty new in the world.
David Weinberger is my guest. He's senior researcher at Harvard's Berkman Center for the Internet and Society. His new book is called Too Big to Know, Rethinking Knowledge Now That the Facts Aren't the Facts, Experts Are Everywhere, and the Smartest Person in the Room is the Room. We'll come back to our talk with David in a few minutes. If you'd like to join us, you can get on the line at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. If you would like to read a copy of David's fascinating book, Too Big to Know, we do have available as a thank you gift today at or above the $120 contribution level. You can make your contribution to KERA, to vibrant public radio in your community, perhaps to this podcast of Think or this radio program. You can do that by going online to kera.org, or you can call in to 1-888-694-6931. Joined once again by Jeff Ramirez, Vice President of KERA Radio Programming. Hey, Jeff.
Hey, Chris. Show sounds great, as usual, day in and day out. Hey, on my way into the studio here, Jackie Boyer from Membership Department gave me a list of names, people to thank, because we've already heard from 7 listeners on our goal of...
We've heard from 9 listeners.
9
on our
listeners.
Goal of 28.
On our goal of
for
28
hour.
For this hour. So thanks to Michael Page in North Richland Hills, Yan-Nan Lee in Plano, Hillary Ricky in Denton, Nicoletta Ballas in Dallas, Don Fisher in Dallas, and there's a note there. Chris says, Jackie says hello. How about that?
All right. Hello.
Wireless radio. How about that? Joseph and Carolyn Geis in Dallas. Thank you all for calling up or using the internet to make your contribution during this hour of Think, because we're working on a goal for this hour of 28 total calls before the end of the hour, and we still need 19 more to stay on track, Chris, with completing this winter membership drive in half the time.
We absolutely want to get it done in half the time. That is something that we have heard from so many of you. We have, Jeff, am I correct that you have never had a complaint call about the fundraising drive being too short? Someone saying, please take more time out of my programming?
Not in 20 years of doing this.
Not once, which is pretty amazing. but your contribution not only ends the drive quickly. I mean, we make a lot of jokes about that. Mm-hmm. But really, what you're doing is funding another year of really good radio. In some ways, and I'm not trying to horn in on David Weinberger's territory here, but public radio is sort of a crowdsourced mm-hmm. project. We come together because we think this resource is important. We all contribute. Many of you contribute in terms of content. Some of you call into the show or write in. You listen. You tell your friends about the programming. But your contributions financially are the things that allow the radio station to continue serving you year in and year out. Your contribution in any amount matters at kera.org or at 1-888-694-6931.
You know, public radio listeners, the smartest room on the radio also includes people who are curious about the world. And Chris, in our last break, I said I couldn't be more delighted to be here with you in the control room, because this is like where it all unfolds. Ordinarily, I'm out doing my midday chores. I'm out at lunch. Sometimes I'm sitting in my car eating my lunch because I can't get out because you've just asked that question, and I know you're going to get into a series of questions with your guest on the radio that's unlike anything else that I'm going to hear on the radio, and I'm sure everyone listening right now knows that there's nothing else on the radio like Think, a way to spend the middle part of your day. So during this membership campaign, we're asking you, after all these years, to join the station for the very first time. You can also renew your membership, renew your faith, renew your support of Think and KERA. You can also make an additional gift to support your public radio station here in North Texas. The toll-free number is 1-888-694-6931, or click and join online at kera.org.
Need an additional 18 calls to stay on track for this hour? We certainly can do that if you will be just one of those callers, one of those contributors. We say calls, we also mean internet contributions. Right. They count the same. 1-888-694-6931 is the number. kera.org is the website. You know, I think about this. We do the show because you as an audience, because you're curious, because you want this kind of programming. You know, if you didn't care for it, there would be no audience, and we wouldn't produce a show like Think here at the station. The reason we're able to, though, and to pay the salaries associated and make sure that the studio is kept up and the equipment is contemporary and works properly, is because of the funding we receive from you. More than half of the dollars it takes to make Think come from people just like you who listen to the show. Some of you are people who can join at the friends level. Some of you are people who can do $5 a month, and that is it, and that is great. We really appreciate your contribution in any amount and your recognition that this doesn't just happen out of nowhere. It doesn't just come into existence from nothing. It comes into existence because of the money that supports it.
Mm-hmm. And honestly, when you hear us on the air, I mean, you know, Jeff Winnington, Chris Boyd, Shelley Koffler, Sam Baker, they're on the air all the time. But, you know, when you hear people like me, other people like April Kinzer in the last hour of Fresh Air, when we're on the air, you hear a real excitement, a sincere, a genuine excitement in our voices, because we're here asking you, letting you know that this is your opportunity to show your support for public radio in North Texas, because it is with your contributions that the station is then able to provide you day in and day out programs like Think that provide you civil discourse, respect for opinion, and really a celebration of the human experience. That's the kind of programming that we're hearing about right now, this hour, and in the next hour of Think. So please support it with your donation right now at 1-888-694-6931 or online at kera.org.
We know this about you demographically, that you typically don't hesitate to spend money investing in your own lifelong learning. You buy books, you go to plays and movies and art exhibitions and scientific exposés, expositions rather.
Whoa,
or exposés. And your investment in KERA is also an investment in your learning and your curiosity and your window on the world. So please let us know that you want public radio in your community by going to kera.org to make a contribution or calling 1-888-694-6931. Thanks.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU Continuing and Professional Education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. Learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is senior researcher at Harvard's Berkman Center for the Internet and Society, David Weinberger. He's got a new book out called Too Big to Know, Rethinking Knowledge Now That the Facts Aren't the Facts, Experts Are Everywhere, and the Smartest Person in the Room is the Room. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. David, I want to talk about this. One of the realities of the modern way that we disseminate information and discover information is that things happen in much smaller bites than they used to. Instead of waiting for an entire report to be complete, we might have little tweets along the way and blog entries and leaks of things. That's good in a way, but it also, is there a consequence in terms of getting information before it has been fully analyzed and interpreted by whatever expert is compiling it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, so you can easily go wrong, and almost all of us do at some point.
Mm-hmm.
We get fooled by a piece of data that isn't ready to be taken seriously, and we lose that little bit of information about the information.
Yeah.
Information about information is called metadata, and metadata is really important. on the internet, because it's how we manage huge flows of information. It's by generating metadata. It's like labels or handles that allow you to classify and organize and decide which things are worth paying attention to and how they might go together. So at a site like archive.org, A-R-X-I-V, this is a site where any scientist can post a paper before it has gone through peer review. So it's a first, it could be a first draft. It could be rough results, initial results. There is tremendous value in this because it speeds up the process. I mean, getting things into print, first of all, very few things make it into print, even good science that should be seen, but it's not important enough science. It takes so long to go through that process that more and more science is being done at sites like archive.org outside of the peer review process, which is fantastic so long as you know when you're there, and the site makes it clear, but you have to pay attention. As long as you know that these are papers and data that have not yet been fully vetted. The scientist is posting them early because she thinks it's going to be useful, not because she's convinced that it's gone through every step that it needs to go through. That sort of metadata is crucial. It's very liberating if you have it. But when you don't, because someone forwards you the paper and you don't know that it came from a site that doesn't have peer review and you take it, that is absolutely one of the many issues, one of many problems for knowledge on the internet.
Let's go to the phones now. 1-800-933-5372 is our number. Brett is on the line in Louisville. Hello, Brett.
Hey, Chris. How you doing?
Great, thanks.
Great. Yeah, I had this was a funny situation we had happen. We had some of our friends sitting around talking, and one of my friends is a physicist, and he started talking about climate change, and I was amazed at how quickly my friends, who are all very well educated, were led off into this, his theory of what climate change was. And this went on for about 5 minutes, and then I reminded him he wasn't a climatologist, and he said, "Yeah, I should have prefaced this by saying I have no idea what I was talking about." But I would love to hear the unofficial expert's review, or what you think of that.
Not only am I an unofficial expert, I actually, since I know experts, Brett, I'm going to deny that I'm an expert at all. I hold them in too much respect. So you're pointing at both sides of this. On the one hand, we really want physicists and others who are not experts in climatology, climate science, to be participating in this. On the other hand, we don't want to be misled by people who don't really have expertise, who may be ill-informed or making things up or just off base. We don't want to be led to think that they have more credibility than they do. It used to be easier because you had to go through some careful process in order to get your works disseminated. There was a peer review process of some form, and there are absolute benefits to that. But there were huge weaknesses as well. It excluded voices that were out of step with the mainstream, for better and for worse. It slowed things down terribly. It excluded people who maybe they weren't climate scientists, but they were physicists and probably had something to contribute. Now we have a different sort of problem, and so it's on the net. It's always dangerous to assume that because you saw it on the internet, it must be true. I think most of us know that at this point. But this is another advantage of knowledge now living within networks, linked networks, where we can see discussion that evaluate many of the claims that are made. This is a wildly imperfect system, but it has some strengths that our previous wildly imperfect system did not have.
Another cool phenomenon of the past several years is that you have information contained on networks that may mean one thing to one set of users and quite another to another. And I'm thinking about some of the social science research that's been applied to things like Facebook. And we can learn about human relationships and about how many friends people have and about their political affiliations. This is not why these sites were developed, and yet other experts can come in and analyze this data because it's all there and it's easy to process.
Yes, I mean, the mere existence of these sites and of the billions of behaviors now that have been recorded on a site like Facebook or Amazon, for that matter, or Google, have a richness of for researchers that could never, ever have been developed off of the web. It has potential for abuse, of course, as well, by commercial entities or governments or whoever, but as a field for the study of social behavior or of the Google Books corpus, I mean, the set of millions of books that Google has scanned as a scholarly research, they allow some researchers to use it, that can tell us a huge amount about how our history of writing, how the pieces are interrelated and what the patterns have been rippling through history there as well.
Sort of amazing, too, that if you remember a phrase you read in a book 30 years ago, but you can't remember the context whatsoever, you might just be able to type that phrase into Google and find the entire work.
Yeah, and this is actually a revolution in the information retrieval field, which began by thinking that in order to manage, you would only index categories applied by professionals, for example,
yeah,
or keywords. And the thought that we, the search engines, are indexing billions and billions, hundreds of billions of pages, and doing so so quickly and requiring no training on the part of users, and we're still able to find content from, you know, in a book that we read 30 years ago, this would have completely, I think the technical term is blown the minds of computer scientists just 20 years ago.
So do you and I, as adults, have the adequate knowledge to sort of, or our generation, I should say, to pass on to the next generation and teach them how to learn all of this? I didn't grow up with the internet, and so I don't quite know what to tell the next generation about using it.
Yeah, and the learning's going to go the other way as well. So there are a set of critical thinking skills that do not change over the years, don't change because of the medium. And the sorts of skills that you needed to evaluate television commercials or op-eds, those skills are still very much needed for evaluating what's on the internet, mm-hmm, but a new set of skills is required as well. And this is often called internet literacy. There's a book by Howard Rheingold coming out about it, and one by Dan Gilmore. And it is a really important topic and a desperately needed skill to teach our children through the educational system.
Do we need to worry about the vulnerability of all this shared information? Because it would be hard for any one person to go and burn down every library in the world, but it's not so hard to shut down a really important shared network.
Well, it's a little bit hard. The internet is pretty resilient, but it's not impossible. Mm-hmm. And we know that a concerted government effort, for example, can, in fact, turn the internet into a closed system that excludes, for all practical purposes, excludes contrary views. We've seen this in some of the largest countries in the world. That is an issue. It's true that it would be difficult to destroy all copies of every book, but it is also possible to, and we have throughout our history, lost lots and lots and lots of works that we now wish we had. A little bit better now, though.
David Weinberger is senior researcher at Harvard's Berkman Center for the Internet and Society. His new book is called Too Big to Know, Rethinking Knowledge, Now That the Facts Aren't the Facts, Experts Are Everywhere, and the Smartest Person in the Room is the Room. David, lots of great stuff to think about. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me, Chris.
Thanks to all of you who have called in this hour, who have participated by sending email, who have listened. Thanks especially to those of you who are supporting members of the station as of today or perhaps as of recently. Your contributions, your financial contributions make it possible for us to present you full hour-long discussions with experts like David Weinberger. You can't find a lot of these discussions on commercial radio. They do a great job, but for a lot of reasons, including the way that they are funded, they're often not given the flexibility and the freedom to discuss interesting, deep, nuanced topics for an entire hour. We're able to do that. We have the freedom to do that because we are supported by you. Your contribution now at KERA.org or at 1-888-694-6931 plays a vital role in the preservation of KERA and of public radio in general in your community. Hello again, Jeff Ramirez.
Hey, Chris. You know, something has changed about knowledge in the last several years. You know what that is?
What is that?
That there's even more of it available here on public radio because of contributions from listeners who we're waiting to hear from right now and listeners who've already called in or gone online and made a contribution. You know, during this hour, we've said we have a goal for this hour's presentation of Think of 28 gifts, 28 contributions to stay on track with completing the drive in just half the time compared to last year. Got great news, Chris, but we still got a little way to go. 10 more gifts before the end of the hour to stay on track.
Let's count this down. I would love to be able to, like a good countdown. Love to be able to tick this off. We do want to thank Emily and Miles Francis in Louisville for their contribution. Thank you, Anthony and Heather Brandt in Van Alstine. Thank you, William Lovelace in Fort Worth. You have some folks to thank as well.
Yeah, in fact, these listeners called in just the last 15, 20 minutes. Maria Moreno in West Worth Village. Allison Walters in Dallas, Desiree and Mark Edwards in Plano. Hey, and look, Susan Butler over in Joshua called in or went online and made a contribution this afternoon.
Thank you, Ramakrishna Konadena in Irving. Thank you, Norma Simpson and Robert Patrizi in Dallas, Liesl McQuillan in Dallas, and Sandra Leisler in Arlington. Really appreciate the fact that you have taken action to support your public radio station, to support this show specifically. Jeff, you can address this. It is not every local public radio station has a show like Think because it's expensive to produce local programming.
Oh, you know, certainly. I mean, imagine what your imagine this time of day. What would you be doing? What would be on your radio? Who would you be spending this hour with if you didn't have Think on the radio? If Chris Boyd wasn't here for you, interviewing, having discussions, having conversations with some of the smartest people in the world. Well, not every radio station around the country has a show like Think. It's here because listeners like you step up and respond to the call to action to become a member or renew your membership during membership drives like the one that we're in right now. So this is your opportunity. You can join the station for the very first time. Chris reminded me that we've had Think on the air now for 5.5 years.
Mm-hmm.
5.5 years. If in all this time you haven't yet become a member, now is your opportunity. This is a membership drive. You can become a new member for the very first time. I guess you can only become a new member for the very first time one, right?
Yes. Once, well, yeah. You can... yes, I was going to make a crude joke, but I'm going to let it go. But yes,
live radio,
you can have more than one first time if you'd like. But we would like for you to renew your membership if it has fallen out of...
I see where you're going. 1-888-694-6931 or click and join online at kera.org.
You know, so many of you have called to participate in this show that I know you're interested to read Too Big to Know, this new book by David Weinberger. I gave a talk a few days ago at the library in Terrell, actually a great group of people. A woman came up to me right after the show, right after that talk, and said, "Tell me again the name of that book you were discussing that you're going to have on the show next week. If you want to read it and you are ready to make your contribution to KERA, we've made it available as a thank you gift. So you can pick that up with a $120 contribution or more at kera.org or at 1-888-694-6931.
Yeah, I know that the residents up there in Terrell were really excited and appreciative that Chris took the time. It was a weekend, right?
No, it was Thursday night.
It was Thursday. It was a Thursday.
Terrific crowd.
It was a Thursday night.
Mm-hmm.
Chris lives here in Dallas. Chris went out to Terrell to visit with folks out there, and I know they were very excited. They wrote up your visit in the newspaper there.
They were
right?
Very kind,
very
yes.
1-888-694-6931 or kera.org. How about making a contribution? Let's say $5 a month. You can do that.
$5 a month. My bank fees are higher than $5 a month.
That's a good point. $10 a month. Hey, and you know, here at the station, we have the Friends level of membership. That's $1,500 a year. You can join, become a friend. And when you put that on your sustaining membership plan, ask about sustaining membership. That's only $125 a month to support a station like KERA that is very important in your life. You learn about things. You are up to date on the most important news events happening in our world. And then you're able to make the best decisions. You can draw your own conclusions, and that's all good for you. It's good for your family and our whole community. So please do something great right now and become a member for the very first time or renew your membership right now at 1-888-694-6931 or click and join online at kera.org.
This time of year, as I'm figuring out my taxes, the family's taxes for the year, I'm always so delighted when I realize, oh, I gave money to KERA. I gave money to the museum. I gave money to the Arboretum. This is the time of year where I reconsider my giving, and I want to make sure that I have plenty of deductions for the next year. Mm-hmm. Your contribution to KERA is tax deductible, so it's something
that?
To think about. Yeah. And this is a service that not only do you support it for other people, but you benefit from it every day. It seems like exactly the perfect place to start your philanthropic giving is with KERA.
Yeah, you know, I've actually met with people who have decided they actually part of their decision to live here in North Texas or retire here in North Texas when they had so many other cities that they could choose to live in is because we have a station like KERA here in North Texas that really is a part of the quality of life. You know, here on KERA, you're hearing programs like Morning Edition, The Diane Rehm Show, Think, Anything You Ever Wanted to Know on Fridays. It's a unique program schedule, not available on any other radio station, public radio station around the country. You're the one that makes KERA with your contribution right now. So we'd love to see you online. We'd love to see you on the phones with your contribution right now.
These goals that we have are not simply our goals. They are your goals. It is in your interest that we make these goals of numbers of contributions, of certain amounts of dollars, of time spent fundraising, because this is your programming and your station. Let us know that you appreciate KERA by making a contribution now online at kera.org, where you can choose from a number of thank you gifts, including copies of David Weinberger's Too Big to Know. You can also become a member or renew your membership over the phone. That number is 1-888-694-6931. Thanks.